You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of November, 2017, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
Ce qui manque le plus à l'Europe aujourd'hui.
What Europe lacks most today, in regards to its defence, is a common strategic culture. At the beginning of the next decade, Europe needs to establish a common intervention force, a common defence budget, and a common doctrine for action.
Pour agir.
French President Emmanuel Macron outlining his hopes for an EU army back in September. Today, he's a step closer. My guests, Alessio Patilano and Terry Stiatzny, will be discussing this and today's other big questions, such as, should world leaders make friends with despots? And do people care when celebrities get involved in international politics? All that, plus...
Shan't be long over this, darling, then we'll go off to bed. You look a bit tired, you know.
Don't hurry, I'm perfectly happy.
What's happened to Britain's adverbs? And should we be frightfully worried? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Alessio Patilano and Terry Stiatzny. Alessio is a lecturer in war studies at King's College London, and Terry is a political journalist and the author of Conflicts of Interest. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we start today in Brussels, where foreign and defence ministers from 23 EU governments gathered at a signing ceremony today to join the EU Defence Pact, paving the way for EU leaders to sign it fully in December. Well, the Permanent Structured Cooperation, or PESCO for short, will allow countries to cooperate more closely on security operations and building up of military capabilities, as well as a hefty €5 billion budget. Well, for France and Germany, the plan seems clear, but what does it mean for others within the EU? Terry, let's start with you. So there's been a lot of debate about the notion of an EU army. Is that what we're seeing here, or are we seeing more some cooperation to make sure that people's weapon systems are compatible?
I think this has been, it's been a very long time in the making. I mean, for as long as I can remember, there have been discussions on having some kind of standing military capability of the EU, and it's taken a very, very long time to get to this point. And of course, it doesn't include even all members of the EU. I mean, you know, for obvious reasons, Britain has not signed up to this, but nor have Ireland, Denmark, Portugal, you know, for their own sort of historical reasons. So I think this is it's a first step. I think we're still a long way off having a big standing European army of any sort. And it's going to be interesting politically, because the deployment decisions are still going to be in the hands of the national government. So to get this EU force to do anything at all, you've still got to get agreement among 23 states. And we've seen with other sort of, it's not, you know, a military alliance with other political groupings, that kind of agreement as to, you know, what the strategic objectives are can be very hard to get. So I think, you know, it's a beginning of something. It's taken a long time to get to this stage. And I think it's probably going to take quite a long time to get much further than this.
Alessio, why do the likes of Macron even want this? What are the benefits? I alluded earlier on to, obviously, if you're going on joint manoeuvres and your tanks are all the same, but we have NATO. Why do we need this as well?
So I think part of the answer to your question has to do with history, and in particular the history of how Europe managed and handled recent security issues that had come up on the horizon. I think more than Macron, we really need to think about the role of Francesco Mogherini here as a powerhouse of a person that has been trying to do something with the European foreign policy, but she was substantially hampered by the fact that European foreign policy did not have any type of substantial tool when it comes to stronger and more robust action. If you think about how long it has taken to try to deal with the question of those who were taking advantage of migrants and sort of ferry them from one side to another, Mogherini was one of the first to talk about, well, we need to do something very specific in order to address the threat in places like Libya, Egypt, but she never had the tool. So I think part of what is happening here is not duplicating NATO. It has to do with the fact that there is a growing sense of consciousness within the European leadership, particularly under Mogherini, that more needs to be done at European level to deal with common security challenges. But this is really early stages. I think there is a discussion to be had as to whether it's going, the ultimate goal is an army in order to pursue whatever objectives the European Union may well have in the future, or rather something more, if you want, considered less sort of far-reaching, rather than thinking European army, but starting to think about command and control functions, which are essential for having any type of operation, situation awareness, domain awareness capabilities, how to start bringing the tools that are necessary to see where the security threats are coming from and when they're coming before you can just take action. And that will be essential. So in that sense, organizationally, the EU has to become a little bit like NATO in order to be able to select how to engage with challenges. On the secondary level, I think this is also about defense industry. So it's about the software, the structure, but it's also the hardware. How to see in the future, we know from all data available that rising powers like China are becoming very important competitors to traditional big European defense industrial firms. How these will organize themselves, well, they need a common framework in order to move forward.
I mean, I think one of the interesting questions for this, you know, cooperation arrangement or force or whatever we should call it is exactly as you say, what it's able to do. I mean, you talk about dealing with Libya. Now, if that was something that we've seen, you know, various navies get involved in what's essentially a humanitarian operation, I can imagine that would be something that's a lot easier to get a political consensus on if we meant by that going into Libya and trying to solve the problem at source, which becomes more political, more strategic, let alone trying to, I don't know, say, back up the Baltic states as members of the EU. Something like that is going to be, A, much more contentious and much harder to get an agreement on. So I think, you know, perhaps what we need to know is in what circumstances people would envisage a European force having some kind of a role. I mean, that's the big question.
I guess what's interesting, what Alessio was saying there is, you know, that this notion that, okay, if it's a migration question and you're dealing with a very local issue that seems to be the source of migrants illegally coming to Europe in a dangerous way, then you might take some intervention. But again, when you talk about the number of governments in the EU, trying to get their approval and anything to do with putting the lives of citizens at risk is politically contentious and dangerous. And for all those governments, they're going to want a bit of a say before they send any of their people into action, aren't they, Terry?
Well, yes, they are. And I think that's the situation that we have at the moment, is that those any deployment decision can still effectively be vetoed. And as you say, you know, take Libya as an example. How much is a humanitarian situation? How much is a massively difficult civil conflict? And then, of course, you look at another layer of history. So, you know, other countries obviously have past relationships with Libya, for instance, or other countries in Africa. That's going to add a whole other level of, you know, potential debate and disagreement as to what their role should be in the future, how keen individual countries are or are able to be on intervention.
So is there a grey area where, you know, some of these things like Libya, you would imagine that, you know, potentially NATO would want a voice there and potentially the EU would want a voice there? And would the EU risk in some of these instances, you know, if it had taken any action in Syria, for example, then you come up against other players like Russia. And at a time like this, the EU doesn't want to be getting into a military standoff with any other powers, does it?
No, you're absolutely right, which is why I think at the moment the key first step, I think we shouldn't sort of be too quick at jumping the gun, as it were, because we're not even in the realm of running into a risk that we're going to have some sort of a confrontational tension with some other big power, because even if they wanted to, they don't really have the basic tools in place to do anything about it. So I think what we're talking about is the very first step. setting up, first of all, a more empowered European Defence Agency, which will have probably a political and military structure not too different from the one that we've seen existing in NATO. You know, once you have these fundamental pieces in place, then you'll start having conversations about how far you can push the agenda, where you want to go, how you can create consensus. Let's not forget, the Europeans do have a model from their eyes. That's NATO. They know that to take any sort of politically sensitive decision, you need to have consensus. So they understand that the path is full of roadblocks. But I think unless you start taking the first step, you'll never make it that 1,000 miles journey in the end.
Well, we'll move on, because Donald Trump's grand tour of Asia is drawing to a close. And with it, as expected, a fresh batch of, can you believe he did this? Why did he say that? Have emerged. Well, one of those being his supposed new great relationship with the Philippine president, Rodrigo Duterte, who reportedly sang a love song for Trump at an official dinner. But an extreme attitude towards criminals, and after recently admitting to murdering someone in his youth, is Duterte the kind of person Trump should be cozying up to? Terry, it's an interesting question, whether we like Duterte or not. He sits in charge of a country which has strategic importance. We're concerned about what's happening in the South Pacific. He seems to be being pulled in towards the orbit of China. Is it actually good if somebody like Trump manages to kind of speak to him in his own language and pull him back into the Western fold?
Yes, I think that you have to talk to leaders that, you know, you don't like. We wouldn't get anywhere if you didn't. I mean, you know, the whole of international diplomacy would pretty much collapse. But as you say, the Philippines has always been massively strategically important to the United States, the importance of, you know, keeping that relationship going. I think the danger is obviously Duterte is trying to play in some ways, I suppose, a more... Obviously, it's had more drastic consequences. I don't want to compare the two directly, but this kind of populist image, I mean, the danger is how the relationship is handled. I mean, you can handle these people, you can handle despotic leaders at arm's distance and make it very clear that you don't like what they're doing. What you probably shouldn't then go and do is have a very jokey press conference where particularly, you know, you make jokes about journalists being spies and so forth. You know, those kind of casual comments, as we've seen in lots of cases recently, have huge consequences. So, I mean, the danger, obviously, with somebody like Trump is that he's not very susceptible to being reined in by the diplomats and the advisors surrounding him and saying, you know, yes, go and meet the guy, but, you know, these are the points that we have to put. These are the points, for instance, on human rights that you need to be making. And, you know, maybe don't find it funny and crack jokes with it.
Alessio, Duterte said that there was never any discussion about human rights and that Trump listened with interest to his tales of what was happening in his country, but never raised a voice against him. Now, we know that under the Obama administration, many of these governments, including Duterte's, you know, there were questions raised and people didn't like it, but it helped push an agenda and a vision of America as trying to protect some kind of freedoms out there. Do you think not mentioning human rights is ever acceptable? Because I guess the counter-argument would be, it's none of America's business how these countries run their affairs.
That's a very good question. I think the answer is what kind of... it depends very much on the kind of foreign policy that you want to run. I think, yes, of course, you're absolutely right. President Obama mentioned and continuously mentioned the human rights question. But then... To what extent it worked, to what extent it was followed up by concrete policy action, that's still open to debate, especially insofar as Asia is concerned. The fact that this was not mentioned during the meeting, I think Terry's absolutely right. It's very much distinctive of Trump's own personal approach to diplomacy. Does that mean that behind doors this discussion would not be carried out? I don't know. I'm not behind those doors. I cannot quite say. I think time will tell what kind of approach to American foreign policy and whether and to what extent human rights have been just put on hold until next person sort of coming to power will raise them again or have just been dealt with in a different way. You know, I think So personally, I can't possibly see, I certainly don't see eye to eye with the new president, and I don't think that his style is one that is conducive to good headlines. But I think in what he's done in Asia, and I think I was surprised, I don't know how many people were, but I definitely was. First of all, he was very moderate. He did not go terribly off the script. It was actually reading of the pieces of paper he had been handed over. And in some respects, for example, in China, when they say, you know, he was talking about China in a certain way, and then he went to China and it was all smile and nice. I think, to be honest, his way of playing in this was much stronger than Obama, you know, previous visits. I mean, he went to China and told Xi Jinping, I like you, you're a great guy, because you have no morality whatsoever. And that's our problem dealing with that. To a man like Xi Jinping, who in China portrays himself as the champion of the new socialist values of Leninist imprint and the morality, he says something like that coming from Trump of all places, it's a very strong message. It's nothing more insulting you can say. So this guy has a different way of dealing with this.
Did he play it well or badly then? So he's ultimately insulted Xi Jinping. Does that gain him anything or lose him anything?
No, I think it depends what was the signalling. And so what I'm saying is that at the moment we simply have not enough. So insofar as the Asia policy is concerned, right? Many other issues, I think we have data to start making assumptions about Trump's behaviour. I think in this respect, there's just too little. This is the first visit. It was a very important visit. it happened at the point in time where the crisis in the Korean Peninsula sort of flared up again. So there was some disruptions, if you want. We need to see the consequences of this trip. What will follow up? That's exactly what will tell us whether this was just another Trump extravaganza trip or something that planted seeds for something new.
Tara, what was your view on his trip? Because it is interesting. In Vietnam, there were, you know, the crowds were out. They wanted to see Trump. He seemed to play it reasonably well in China. And did you get the impression that he was having a successful trip?
I think as far as we've seen, and certainly having not seen that much of it from a UK point of view, and UK, it's obviously depends how it's played, A, with the audience in the US and with the audience in various countries. But it does seem to have been, I think, relatively successful. I mean, it does seem to have passed off without any sort of massively dramatic incidents, possibly overfeeding some fish. So it does suggest that despite, you know, the State Department is obviously still plugging away there and trying to, you know, manage these meetings very carefully. I think we're just surprised in ways to see Trump actually having the stamina to go through a long, complicated trip like this. Because, you know, from everything we hear that he doesn't have that much of a long attention span. He prefers to take time off. And for him to actually pull off, you know, a long, complex trip like this without, touch wood, you know, anything completely disastrous, maybe shows that despite the State Department being very understaffed, not having the resources, not having a lot of the appointments that it needs, that they are still capable of organising this. And I think in terms of the question, you know, of raising human rights, I mean, we often see leaders go to places like China, go to places like Saudi Arabia, and there is a big difference between what is put on for public show and for the audiences of, say, China or Saudi Arabia that they see, and then what goes on behind the scenes. I suppose the bigger question is whether the Trump administration thinks that human rights is, you know, a foreign policy goal to any extent. I mean, you know, in the past, often Republican presidents haven't really seen that that's, you know, they're purely thinking about strategy and trade and so forth, and that does slip down the agenda. So maybe they are looking at this through a different prism and not seeing that as the most important thing that they're trying to pursue.
Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tark, and Alessia Patilano and Terry Stiatsny. And coming up next, Bob Geldof. Well, remember him? Well, he stepped back into the political limelight, but does anyone care? Well, we'll find out after this. Stay tuned.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Alessia Pasolano and Terry Stiatsny. Now, back in August, the world watched in horror as hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims fled their homes in Burma across the border to neighbouring Bangladesh. Aung San Suu Kyi, the former political prisoner, now de facto leader, seemingly stood in silence, refusing to condemn the acts being committed by the military. And then the story kind of drifted away. But today it's back in the headlines, thanks seemingly to one man, Bob Geldof. The singer, activist and general busybody and do-gooder has made a name for himself for speaking out against all sorts of subjects over the years, and he's not alone. But does anyone really care what celebrities think, and does it ever really make a difference in the political sphere? Terry, in a way, we're talking about it, so it kind of does make a difference, doesn't it?
I mean, yes, that's precisely one of the things I was going to say. I mean, what celebrities can bring in the first place, they can bring attention, they can bring money. I mean, let's not forget that, for we call him busybody, Bob Geldof is someone who did actually help to change international policy on a pretty massive issue in the past. I mean, you look at the Ethiopian famine and Live Aid and raising money. You know, I think he probably would have learned from that that, you know, yes, you can get involved and you can change things. And he has campaigned since on, you know, global development, debt, other issues like that. I think you can bring the limelight. The question is then how you follow that through. You know, do you set up some kind of a campaign, an institution or whatever? If you just make a remark, make a grand gesture, you know, in this case, you know, return your honor, that's not necessarily going to do anything in the long term. But sort of sustained campaigning, which is sort of informed and intelligent, I think can help.
I think it's interesting also, let's say that, you know, the feeling that people don't want to be in the same club as her at the moment, that's a quite a shocking turn of events. So we know people like Bob Geldof and U2 did a lot of campaigning actually for her freedom and trying to kind of raise the question of her curtailment when she was kept under house arrest in Burma. So they must feel immensely disappointed to see that her silence on this issue has been just so awful. So in a way, they have helped her in the past. They have a right to criticise, don't they?
I think that's correct. But it connects to the point that Harry was making earlier on. First of all, you are a person that is well known on a broader scale. So your message matters. And I think if you connect that with the point you just made, that's the very important sort of statement altogether. If someone that supported her, if someone that wanted to make her situation known beforehand and now is turning around and says, hang on a moment, something terribly wrong is going on here, and starts taking distance from her, I think that's a very important statement. Now, again, the key issue is, as Terry rightly pointed out, is what's going to happen next. You know, we know that the most successful campaigns by celebrities are the ones that have a follow-up, whether it is through a charity, through them being associated with causes that allow their problem to stay an issue, to be at the front, on the front lines. So I think very much will depend on how it sort of moves on from here. But I suppose that if anyone were to make a statement and made it sort of more important than it would have been otherwise among celebrities, certainly by Bob Geldof coming out and turning around and say, like, you know, this person, I was there when she was in prison politically. Now I'm here because she's doing something that I think is terrible. I think that's a very, very important statement. And it makes it even more important and sort of trying to draw the attention to the issue itself.
I think, Terry, it's interesting, as you say, Bob Geldof has a long record of doing campaigning around all sorts of issues. In various bits of my life, when I've been in newspapers, it was always slightly depressing to get the call from the charity that said, oh, we have X, you know, film star going out to Africa or going to this project, you know, would you like to come and cover our work because they are going? And I always thought that was, you know, a no. But then I would read papers afterwards and there was so much pickup on the story because there was a celebrity there seeing what poverty looked like and experiencing it firsthand. Do you think that we often, we spend so much time trying to understand the lives of these people that actually they do become quite good conduits into those worlds, even for quite serious issues?
Yes, I think that can work. I mean, I think there's a whole, you know, since Live Aid, and then we've had Comic Relief and so on. Mm. There's a pretty much an established, as you say, this way of campaigning where you send, you know, I don't know, David Beckham or someone to a refugee camp, and they, you know. But whether we like it or not, I think it obviously charities and NGOs find that it works for them because it gets, as you say, you know, attention, money, so forth. And, you know, that is, it is a way into, I mean, these stories are quite hard to understand, you know, if we're all talking, you know, we sit here and we talk about, you know, global strategy and politics and such things. A lot of people aren't paying attention to the news, particularly to the international news, most of the time. And if you can get a certain amount of input. But as you say, I mean, you look at, say, for instance, another good example, I would say, is someone like George Clooney campaigning on Sudan, on Darfur. I mean, he's someone who's done the work. So it's not just let me fly in for a couple of days, you know, look a bit sad and fly out again. I mean, I don't think that has much to contribute, you know, beyond a few sort of likes and clicks and things on social media. But someone who, you know, who puts in the work and then and gets involved, you know, good luck to them.
Yeah, and often we criticise these people for having a privileged life and not doing anything good, and then when they do do something good, we still criticise. So it's tough anyway. But anyway, finally, before we go today, an awfully sticky situation for those keen to protect the English language.
You think we might have that down a bit, darling? Hi, Laura.
Yes, dear?
If you were miles away.
Was I? Yes, I suppose I was.
Do you mind if we turn that down a little? It really is deaf.
Of course not.
Shan't be long over this, darling, then we'll go off to bed.
You look a bit tired, you know.
Don't hurry, I'm perfectly happy.
A clip there from 1945's rather romantic Brief Encounter, and a prime example of gradable adverbs, words added to understate the meaning of the phrase. Now, there's a report out today saying that they're endangered, that they're kind of falling out of use. Do you use any of these words when you looked through the list, Terry?
I'm somewhat distressed by this. I find it rather upsetting. Yeah, I think it would be, I would terribly, I'm going to do it all the time now, you know, I just want to stop me. I do think it would be very sad if you lose the kind of the art of the great British understatement. A great book, I don't know if you ever read the book called How to Be an Alien, which was published in the 1950s by a Hungarian emigre to Britain. He was explaining everything from tea to, you know, how Britain works generally. And he said the English have no soul, they have the understatement instead. And sort of went on to list all these kind of, you know, what people meant by saying, you know, I'm rather upset, or I'm, you know, somewhat perturbed. And, you know, I think that's it's part of the English language, and it's part of the British character. So I think if that were to go, I'd be, yeah.
Alessio is an Italian by birth, but someone who knows everything about the English language. Do you still get tripped up by people every now and then using these gradable adverbs and downplaying the meaning of what they're saying?
I actually like it. I think it's one of the things that really makes the English language so pleasant and to engage with, you know, how to develop a certain sort of nuances and sophistication and in a way hiding a far deeper reservoir of feelings and emotions. I think that's something also that, you know, as a foreigner here, when you then go to America where emotions are so in your face, you can see the difference. That's what the beauty of the language is all about, you know, seeing how differences allow you to express something that is just beyond the individual, but it makes your community all together. So I think it's a real shame if that's being lost. And again, as someone who started to learn English, not as a first language, that's definitely where, when you start seeing everybody, I remember when I was doing my master's here many years ago, everybody said, like, how are you? It's like, oh, yeah, it's all right. Actually, they never meant that. And there were so many other things. So that intrigues you and brings you into sort of trying to understand more. So it would be a very great shame.
And I like all these rather 30s ones that have hung over, that like, terribly nice and awfully decent, because they do confuse people. Because there's a negative and a positive kind of sitting sitting side by side. Well, anyway, apparently they're slightly threatened, but we'll do our best to maintain their use on this rather awfully good radio station. But that does bring us to the end of today's show. Alessio Pastellano and Terry Stiazny, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Today's show, it was produced by Bill Luti. It was researched by Eileen Goffin and also by Chloe Carnesis. And our student manager was George McDonough. Well, there's more music next, and at 1900 hours, it's Culture with Mr. Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours, London time. Midori House, well, of course, is going to be back the same time tomorrow. But from me, Angie Tuck, goodbye.